This is To Be Fair NI. The Pills Project podcast celebrating the activists and allies using the law to change lives. In each episode, we'll give you a seat at the pills table and bring you into our public interest world to give you a sense of the work that we're doing on a daily basis in Northern Ireland. Welcome back to Be Fair NI, where we are continuing our series of deep dive episodes, exploring three big issues that the Pills Project are prioritising in our work right now. If you missed our previous episodes on climate justice and the human rights infrastructure, please go back and check them out. We were lucky enough to get two great interviews with the Northern Ireland Human Rights Commission and Environmental Justice Network Ireland. Those are well worth a listen. Today's episode comes with a health warning. It's about the hostile environment for asylum seekers and migrants created by the UK government, and it's a toxic concept. Now, before Conservative politician Theresa May wrote books about injustice in public life, she had the dishonour of coining the phrase the hostile environment itself. Remember those vans with the big go home adverts splashed across them? The ones directed at migrants? Well, that campaign sums up the hostile environment in a nutshell. It's nasty, headline-grabbing fodder fueled by a desire to stoke division as opposed to any well-thought-out policy objective. That advertising campaign was rolled out in 2013 during May's time at the Home Office, and its overtones linger to this very day. I suppose that might lead some listeners to the conclusion that cruel policies like this don't actually stop migration at all. Anyway, this episode is all about why this soul-crushing policy doesn't actually work, how it impacts all of us, not just those of us who are migrating and seeking safety, and, to go back to this podcast's hopeful origins, it's also about what we at Pills and communities and organisers across Northern Ireland are doing about it. And I'm delighted to say that I'm joined by not one, but two experts to dissect the hostile environment. Later in the episode, you'll hear from barrister and blogger Colin Yeo. But first, I spoke to our very own Maria McCluskey, because prior to becoming Pills director, Maria practiced as an immigration solicitor, representing child victims of trafficking, as well as children and young people who were applying for asylum on their own. So I suppose to start off with, when we say, as the Pills Project, we're working on dismantling or tackling or resisting the hostile environment, it might just be good to start off with what we actually mean when we say the hostile environment, because for me, who's initially, maybe I started off thinking of the hostile environment as just those pieces of legislation, the restrictive policies that make people who are moving to the UK or attempting to move to the UK to seek safety, make their life difficult. But it's the combination of that with the horrible, toxic rhetoric that comes with it. So I suppose you're the perfect person to ask, Maria, on this podcast, because not only are you director of the project that's working on this issue, but your previous experience as well as a practitioner in this area. When we say the hostile environment, what does it mean to you?
So for me, the hostile environment is, as you say, that combination of the policies, the legislation that have been introduced by successive governments over the last number of years, which make it more and more difficult for those who have come here seeking asylum, but also for those who are coming here under different immigration routes, who are maybe already here and who wish to remain and are using different routes in the immigration system to do so. But year upon year, it gets more difficult. And we could think about all the legislation that has been passed with regards to seeking asylum in the UK. So it's all of that, but it is mixed in with this undercurrent and sometimes overcurrent, really. I mean, it's quite overt on occasions, the rhetoric and the terminology and the language are used around people who are either seeking safety or who wish to live in the UK and who have a right to do so. So, I mean, it is difficult to pinpoint it as one thing, but it is this combination of overt and not so overt toxic rhetoric, really, combined with the policies and the legislation.
That's a really good way to sum it up, because I think even the term in and of itself, the hostile environment, it sounds almost as if it's this entity that has sprung up naturally on its own, that it wasn't created. So I think it's really important, as you've done, is to name where it's coming from. It is coming from this current UK government. It has been deliberately created. This is an issue that affects all of us. This is an everybody issue, because the hostile environment, as it creeps out and as it puts pressure on doctors or on teachers or on employers to sort of become de facto immigration officials, this is not just something that affects particular communities. It's something that is actively harming all of us.
Absolutely. I mean, if we're not integrated as a community, you know, we are separated, and that gives rise to tension, that gives rise to issues in communities which don't need to be there. I mean, when I was working as an immigration solicitor at the Children's Law Centre, I had a number of young people who either were going through the immigration or the asylum application process. Some of them had got through the asylum application process, were granted asylum, and were coming up against barriers. And all the while, it chips away at somebody's self-worth. And I mean, the other thing about it is, some people don't know they're coming here. They are trafficked into this country. They don't necessarily know where they are. But for the young people that came, who had so much resilience and had come through so much on their journey and survived horrific ordeals on their journey, they were somehow still so vibrant and full of hope. I mean, the coming here, the getting here to them was, thank you, I'm so glad to be here. And month by month by month, you could see the spark going out of their eyes. It was horrible to witness. It chips away, you could see it chipping away at their souls. It chipped away at our souls, the people that are working with them, because there was nothing we could do to speed up the process to get to the end point, which was all they needed was their papers. And let's not forget, the vast majority of people who come to this country seeking asylum are granted asylum because they have a right to claim asylum under the Refugee Convention.
That image, if we were calling the policy soul-crushing, I think people would feel an awful lot different about the actual end result that it has on people. When you could see that physical, I suppose, as well as emotional toll that that was taking on the children that you were working with. I mean, it must have an incredible impact on practitioners as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm full of admiration for some of the practitioners out there who have been doing this for years. I was not strong enough, and that's just the reality. I wish I had been. You know, I got so emotional because there were barriers put up that didn't need to be put up. And, you know, these young people were, I mean, literally begging me to get them in to see a mental health practitioner, for example, even though I knew that was such a hurdle to even say that they needed it, because in their own cultures, you know, you would never admit that you needed help with your mental health. And when they were saying, please, I need to speak to somebody, and there was nothing I could do, I didn't prepare myself for, I suppose, the impact it would have on me. And I don't really like to talk about it because, you know, what they came through was way worse than what I'll ever even know in this life. I know it is. But yeah, I did find it difficult. And that was part of, yeah, it was definitely, I knew I couldn't do that for much longer. Coupled with the fact then that when the opportunity came up with the Pills Project, and its main aim is to use strategic litigation to change the policy, to change the practice for everyone, it made a lot of sense to me that rather than in every case for these young people, effectively what felt like banging your head off a brick wall and asking for the same thing over and over and over again, that if we could get that one case that might change the experience for everybody else coming behind, that would probably, in my mind, be a better use of my time and my emotional energy. So it's not perfect and it's not a panacea, but theoretically it makes a lot more sense. And yes, I did at that point need to change the environment in which it was working.
I can see from sitting opposite you how emotional you get when you're talking about that even a few years removed from it. And I think that probably underlines why we wanted as a project to make this an area that we were focusing on.
Yeah, I think that the sentiment around immigration and asylum is not the same in this jurisdiction as what it is elsewhere, particularly in England. The vast majority of people in Northern Ireland are welcoming of those who come from other cultures. And there is a real, I think we're on the precipice of a potential change and a worrying change because of what has happened in Dublin and the ongoing growing rhetoric from, you know, certain elements of the media. So it is a scary time because I feel that welcoming environment that has existed for so long through so much of what has happened in immigration asylum, there is a risk that that is going to change, and I'm very worried about that. But for now, the vast majority of people are very welcoming. There's so much to be gained from, you know, meeting new people from different places, hearing their stories, hearing about their lives. We get that here on our doorsteps every day, and I think it's wonderful to see.
It's very important that we talk about this in an election year. You know, I would hope that spirit of welcome that you talked about, that we can hold on to that here, because the we, when we talk about it, the government, I think, have tried to make that we very small and to create little pockets of division, whereas the we can be an awful lot bigger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, one of the examples of how awful these policies are, and one of the most stark examples that I've seen in recent times, is the not just the resistance or lack of welcome to people who come here to seek safety, but actually the criminalisation of those people now. A young man from Senegal called Ibrahima Ba, who has been sentenced to 9 years in prison for illegal entry and manslaughter by gross negligence. This is a young man who I think is now 20. So when he left Senegal, he was a minor. He had a very traumatic journey. And he gave evidence that when he was put in a dinghy on the coast of France, he was forced to steer that dinghy. And when the dinghy was partway through the journey, a fishing vessel was spotted and people who were in the dinghy stood up, and that resulted in water coming in. A number of people died. And this young man was charged with these offences and ultimately found guilty, despite the fact that he was a victim of trafficking, despite the fact that he gave evidence that he was tortured and beaten and coerced into steering this dinghy, because that's what traffickers do. They don't steer the dinghy themselves. And despite the fact that people who were on that vessel gave evidence in court to say that if it wasn't for him, more people would have died. And I just think that is so wrong. And I think if most people heard that story, they would agree that it's wrong too. That's where I'm going to leave it.
Thank you so much, Maria. It's stark, isn't it? But that's the reality that lies beneath innocuous sounding terms like the hostile environment or the compliant environment. When you see it up close, it's really nasty stuff. And next up is somebody else who's very familiar with the hostile environment and what it looks like in practice. Our guest, Colin Yeo, is an immigration and asylum barrister, a consultant at Garden Court Chambers in London, and founder of the very well-known blog, Free Movement. Colin is also the author of a particularly memorable series of Twitter threads reviewing the Paddington Bear films from an immigration lawyer's perspective. Highly recommend those. In 2022, Colin also wrote a blog with the somewhat provocative title, Strategic Litigation, More Harm Than Good. And as a project dedicated to these type of cases, I wanted to dig into that a bit more with him. But I began by asking Colin about staying sane as an immigration practitioner in the midst of constant change.
Well, the cheat answer is that I pay Sonia Lenigan to do it for me. Sonia's brilliant, and she's sort of taken over as editor a few months ago now, well, coming up a year ago. And the two of us work quite hard to try and stay up to date. And it is hard. And I've found that, my sort of private practice as a barrister has waned as a result, because it absorbs a lot of time trying to sort of keep Free Movement running. And obviously this staying up to date with what's going on keeping an eye on things through Twitter, through RSS feeds, through kind of emails that we've subscribed to, reading all of that material, keeping an eye on the case law databases. That's a lot of work. Plus, there's all the kind of unseen stuff that people don't really know about or think about just keeping free movement going as a kind of institution and business as well. And that takes quite a lot of that absorbs quite a lot of time too.
I think it was Katie from Kingsley & Napier who'd written a piece, and it's probably almost 4 years old at this stage, that the hostile environment is not just created for people who are interacting with the immigration and asylum system firsthand. You know, the hostile environment affects immigration practitioners as well. So just when you're having to trawl through all of that on a daily basis, is it easier to switch off in the evening now, or is it becoming harder? I know free movement has been going since 2007, so I don't know if it's becoming easier or harder to switch off at night when you close the laptop.
I find it easier these days to switch off in the evening. I make more of an effort to, and you know, I find that I sleep better as a result. So yeah, when it was just me on my own, it was very difficult not to just sort of constantly be keeping an eye on things and being afraid that you've missed something and wanting to stay up to date. There was a certain amount of filtering, and it's one of the debates we're having within the team at Free Movement is how far we should be trying to cover everything that seems relevant, and how far we should be sort of deliberately trying to filter that for people. So, for example, we won't always cover reports that, you know, even really good NGOs have written. We won't cover all cases. There's a certain amount of England, Wales High Court stuff we won't cover, because it's, you know, detention cases, for example, tend to be fairly kind of factually specific unless there's some particularly interesting feature to them. So we sort of by necessity used to take have a policy of filtering stuff, because I just couldn't do it all. And we're sort of discussing how far we should sort of deliberately try to filter so that we're just picking out the important stuff. But it's really hard, because we know that we've got a wide readership. You know, our email list is 30,000 people now. It feels absolutely astonishing. And, you know, that includes a really diverse group of people. So it's not just immigration lawyers. It's also campaigners, a lot of policy people, journalists. And, you know, there's all these different interest groups within that audience. And it's very, well, we can't really keep everybody happy all of the time, because, you know, stuff that some people will feel like we shouldn't have covered, or their inboxes are being bombarded, other people will be interested in. So it's kind of constant problem for us. More it's a problem for our audience, but we're aware of that. So we try to make it our problem as well.
Because we know that the hostile environment is probably going to be a feature in many election manifestos, and it's something that candidates are going to be talking to us about over the next few weeks and months. I'm just wondering, is there something that you think we should be paying attention to in particular?
It's a really, really difficult question. And this is a really lawyerly sort of start to an answer. It depends a bit what you mean by hostile environment. So if we mean in the broader sense of just being horrible to migrants, which is, you know, something that the government does, and partly for political reasons, partly because they think it deters people from coming, there's no evidence that it does, or whether you mean hostile environment in a slightly more specific sense, sort of academic sense of that kind of idea of deputized third-party immigration controls, you know, immigration controls being carried out by non-immigration officials, whether it's the National Health Service or other public authorities, or it's employers and landlords and banks and building societies and so on. And, you know, with an election coming up, I think it's inevitable that the opposition parties, particularly the Labour Party in England and Wales and Scotland, isn't going to want to alienate potential voters. You know, that's part of what being a broad-based political party is all about. You know, you're not just appealing to one group of people, you're appealing to as wide a group of people as possible. And in a sort of political system like the one we're in, you can't get everything you want. Yes. As you know, as much as I might have a policy agenda or someone that I would like a political party to subscribe to, I don't, you know, that's just not how it works. You have these kind of broad-based political parties. So I don't think we can expect much from Labour in terms of positive commitments, unless they really have to. you know, to be fair, they've been quite specific on one particular thing, which is that they don't like the Rwanda plan and they will repeal it. And they've stuck to that despite quite a lot of pressure from the government. So you know, if they do win the election, as appears to be the case, according to the opinion polls at the moment, then we would expect them to follow through on that. But they've said nothing about the wider hostile environment, you know, whether we mean that in the kind of broad sense or the more technical deputized controls sense. And you know, we just don't know really what their plans might be. And I don't mean that as a criticism of Labour, because I can understand why we don't know, and we all just have to kind of cross our fingers and hope that they'll go for something, you know, that we broadly sort of want and agree with, even if we can't get everything that we want.
Strategic litigation is one of the things, it's one of the sort of the core tenets of our work as an organisation. And I was just curious to chat to you a little bit more from an immigration and asylum perspective. How useful do you think it actually is as a tool? I know that a couple of years ago that you were like, there's a couple of good examples, but overall it hasn't really been that effective. Do you still feel the same, or has there been anything over the past 2 years that you've seen that has been a success from your point of view?
Yeah, that piece that I wrote, it's a while ago now, and it was based on a talk I gave even more time ago. I've been a bit of a skeptic about strategic litigation for quite a long time. That doesn't mean all strategic litigation, but I have my concerns about it, and I've seen some fairly bad cases go forward in immigration and fail and either make things worse or at least kind of embed, you know, a kind of poor status quo more so than it had been previously. And occasionally you see cases that succeed, but then, you know, lead to legislative reversal, which makes the situation, again, arguably worse than it was previously. But you know, against that, there are some standout successes. So the, you know, the challenge to the detention fast track, I think, really stands out as being just a massive win. I've got mixed feelings about it. You know, there are successes, but there have been failures as well. And one of the things that I sometimes worry about with strategic litigation is that there's a kind of I just feel there's a conflict of interest sometimes between the lawyers and the clients. And it depends how you know, it depends on the way that you bring the case. And if you know, if you're acting on behalf of specific clients, they're effectively guinea pigs or kind of martyrs. You know, there's different different metaphors we can draw on to describe their very uncomfortable situation that they're in. And they might say that they're willing, but becoming the kind of emblem of a cause is a really big thing to do. It's taking a lot on personally. Yeah, and I'm not talking about the costs risk here, although there is that. I'm talking about kind of emotional and stress kind of pressures. And I don't think lawyers really appreciate that, quite frankly. But, you know, if you want to win a strategic case, then having an actual human being at the center of it, I think, is desirable. And if you try to bring a case as an organization, then, you know, there are problems with that around potentially withstanding, again, with costs, risks. And also, you know, the Home Office is very savvy in our field. They'll grant status to people. And, you know, again, you know, saying to somebody, oh, well, we want you to carry on with this litigation, even though you got what you wanted to, because think of all the other people. That's a massive ask to be making of somebody. Or, you know, you bring it as a weaker case as an organization with all the risks taken on yourself as well. So I think it's really difficult. It's really complicated. And, you know, there are situations where it does seem to work. There are situations, I think, where it's necessary. You know, there's you know, a client has just no option but to bring a case. I think there are pros and cons to strategic litigation as a kind of campaigning tool as well. And, you know, we've increasingly seen, especially in the era of crowdfunding, you know, people use strategic litigation to draw attention to their cause without much regard, sometimes it seems, to the actual merits of the litigation and to the environment that then creates for other litigants who are not voluntary litigants, you know, who have to bring applications for judicial review in order to protect their situation. They don't want, you know, they don't want to, but they've got to. So it's a really interesting issue, and I think it's a really complicated one.
all of the things that you've just said, I think, really sum up our approach to it as well, is that nobody would choose to be in that position. Our real focus is about supporting those cases that, but for the existence of quite a niche organization like ourselves, wouldn't go ahead. And we've always discussed strategic litigation in that way, is that it can be a terribly lonely place, not to minimize at all the fact that you will then end up being sort of the poster child for a particular issue. And our intention is to sort of build a community around the case, in that nobody ever really is sort of left to their own devices. So as you say, it's never just as simple as, you know, strategic litigation good, other litigation bad. Sometimes people dearly want to go and have their day in court and feel vindicated, that we're sort of saying, look, this is not a silver bullet. This judicial review is a very niche thing. It might not work for you. From a personal perspective, thank you for encouraging people to think a little bit more critically about it.
And no, thank you for saying that, because I did get a little bit of blowback on that blog post when I published it. Sonia was in touch and said, "I see you've chosen violence today." Yeah, it's just kind of, she was winding me up slightly. I think the thing is, when you're a lawyer, and you know, we're all, I'm trying to think how to put this carefully. You know, lawyers do tend to have egos, and you know, they like to be in the legal directories, they like to you know, be involved in big cases. You know, when you're a young lawyer, you want to have your name in the law reports and all this kind of thing.
Absolutely.
And strategic litigation is one way to achieve that. Lawyers have a kind of, they like to do it. You know, we all want to kind of change the world and stuff, or a lot of us do, and that looks like a way to achieve it. But you know, it's not necessarily the best way to do it. And you know, I think kind of broad-based campaigns, political campaigns, are often a better way, I think, of achieving change. And I recognize that strategic litigation can play a role in that. It makes me a bit uncomfortable, but I do recognize that. But I think doing the strategic litigation without the public-facing campaign and without the kind of hard graft that involves is not a good way to achieve change, and it can potentially be counterproductive.
You know, none of this happens in a vacuum. If you're taking a case, and if you haven't really thought about how you're going to coordinate that, somebody else is going to package and frame and talk about the issue, and the story is going to go in a completely different way, one that you can no longer control, and you're not framing the issue anymore.
The whole Illegal Migration Act is a bit of it's a bit of a nightmare, because it looks legally quite powerful. You know, it's not easy to challenge if it ever gets operationalized. It's just, I still really, even at this stage, struggle to believe that the Home Office will impose a duty to remove potentially tens of thousands of people per year to Rwanda, or leave them in permanent limbo in this country, and because that's what it does. And it's just so obviously impossible to do. Aside from the morality of it, it's just, you know, no government can ever do that. They're obviously going to have to scrap it. A government is going to have to scrap it at some point if it ever gets brought into force properly. And I think they're going to call an election during that time, you know, before it becomes obvious that it's a stupid idea, and as well as immoral. And then you know, they can fight the election partly on the basis that they've got this marvelous plan that they've started to put into force, and don't stop us now because this is going to solve all these problems and so on. Whereas actually, you know, those people understand what's required by it, just understand that it's never going to happen. Actually, it's not a solution to anything.
Even on that, it's just interesting to sort of see, as you say, the tactics that people are using. Even outside, you know, traditional judicial review in Northern Ireland, there's a great campaigning organization. When you were talking about the effectiveness of political campaigns, the Participation and Practice of Rights are a grassroots led organization, and their campaign leaders, who are asylum seekers and refugee communities based in Belfast and across Northern Ireland, are running a campaign that's all about the kind economy. So it's trying to sort of tackle the hostility of the sort of the mindset that you were talking about, that toxic mindset part of what the hostile environment is made up of, through a campaign called the Kind Economy. The Human Rights Commission in Northern Ireland is challenging the Illegal Migration Act and things like that. So there is quite a bit going on in Northern Ireland as well. So if we can ever send you over stuff, if it's useful for free movement, just let us know, because we're more than happy to share what's going on here. Thank you so much, Colin. I've gone over my half an hour that I promised I would keep you to by 4 minutes. So
it's been a pleasure. So thank you very much for having me on.
I know there's been a lot of information to absorb in this bumper episode. And as a listener, I'm sure you're thinking, okay, you've convinced me it's awful. So what are pills going to do about the hostile environment? Those are my thoughts exactly. So let's go back to Maria and I, where we discuss exactly that. Listen in for great examples of local Northern Ireland-based resistance and hear how you can get involved in our work to tackle the hostile environment. People listening to this might be thinking, okay, well, immigration, that's an issue for Westminster. What can organisations in Northern Ireland do? There's great examples of the work that our neighbours in this building and the Human Rights Partnership are doing, just to give, I suppose, a bit of space to say why this is a Northern Ireland issue and as well what's going on.
Yes, there is great work going on by the organisations that we work with. Obviously, you know, CAJ have produced a report which gives the local government here at the Northern Ireland Assembly an opportunity to look at ways in which they can potentially counteract some of the hostile environment policies coming from Westminster. You know, there are powers within our devolved legislation to make life a little bit better. I mean, I can't really say it any you know, more simply than that. So that is a great report, and I know that they're working on presenting something to our elected politicians. We have the challenges to the Illegal Migration Act by the Northern Ireland Human Rights Commission, and also Sinead Marmion at Phoenix Law, who is bringing a specific case in relation to the impact of that legislation on unaccompanied minors in particular. You know, PILS has worked with the Human Rights Consortium. We developed briefings, and PILS is always you know, there to help anybody who wants to bring the strategic litigation challenges, and is doing so in the background with different cases at the moment. We've also got our country of origin report project to assist local practitioners who are bringing applications or putting asylum applications forward on behalf of their clients, to try and ease that burden of the amount of work that goes into an asylum application. So there's lots going on.
Just for anybody who's listening, and when we talk about country of origin within sort of immigration and asylum, what those reports actually are, because that's something that Kate in our team will be able to assist people with.
And the country of origin report service is effectively, it's a report that's produced to provide support to the evidence that someone gives in their asylum application. So if, for example, if someone says, I came from Eritrea, I was conscripted to the army, I escaped, you know, it's really telling the court, yes, what this person has said about their country is factually correct. So we've teamed up with Clifford Chance, and basically when we get a practitioner who said, okay, I have a client who wishes to claim asylum, they're from X country, they said this happened to them, we refer it on to Clifford Chance, and we get back a very professional report, which then is very effective in using in the asylum application process.
And from what you said earlier, Maria, it sounds like that, and this is probably our thinking behind wanting to get involved in this project, is because there are not a huge amount of immigration practitioners in Northern Ireland. Those that are working are under massive pressure. So it sounds like a scheme like this to provide those reports and to provide them in a timely way is something that we hope is particularly powerful and particularly useful.
Yeah, I hope so. I believe so at the minute, especially given the crisis, as you say, of representation that we're calling it, where people are leaving the practice area effectively because it is an unsustainable area of practice. The legal aid rates haven't increased in over 20 odd years. And if effectively there's just not enough time to do what's required in these asylum applications within the confines of the fee that you get for ultimately taking it through the court system. So it's hopefully going to relieve that burden. And as we say with all our services, it is no substitute for a properly funded legal aid system. But when we're in the situation that we're in, we've got to do whatever we can to try and make that process easier for both the client and the solicitor. And another thing that I think is, you know, so unique to this jurisdiction, and has I have seen firsthand the impact of it, and that's the Independent Guardian Service.
We can put some links and stuff in the show notes as well, but just to give just a little bit of background as to who the Independent Guardians are.
So the Independent Guardian Service was created under the 2015 trafficking legislation for Northern Ireland, and effectively it provided a statutory right for any unaccompanied or separated child who entered Northern Ireland to have that support of an independent guardian. Barnardo's have had the contract for delivering the Independent Guardian Service since its inception and still hold the service. So the Independent Guardians are, you know, employees of Barnardo's, but all have at least 5 years experience as a social worker beforehand. But they've all actually been trained in immigration and asylum law as well. And you know, the support that the young people that I worked with got from the Independent Guardians was so important. And we are lucky to have that in this jurisdiction. We have it because it's written in our statute under devolved powers of trafficking. And I think it's important to remember that that's an area, for example, that we should, I believe, resist what I call a power grab by Westminster, because it is within our devolved competencies, as is health and social care. So, you know, the care that's provided to these young people and to others in the immigration system, you know, that's a devolved power. So there are different ways in which I think we can try and mitigate against the worst impacts of the hostile environment. And I think there are some organisations doing great work in that arena.
If you're listening to this and you are a lawyer, or you are a member of a PILS organisation, be it that an NGO or a solicitor firm, and you are either working on immigration or you are listening to this thinking, I want to do something about it, I will pop a link to all our services in the show notes, because we are not going to let this lie. So the more people that we can add to that, we are opposing this and we are going to do something about it, the better. And to close the episode, I just want to say a massive thank you to both of my guests, Colin and Maria. They shared really personal reflections at times, and I know it wasn't always an easy conversation to have, but I'm just so glad that both of them trusted me and trusted PILS and trusted To Be Fair NI with their stories. Thank you again, and I'll talk to you again soon. To Be Fair NI is a podcast series created by the Public Interest Litigation Support Project. Editing of this episode is by me, Emma Cassidy. Stay tuned for more conversations with the activists and allies using the law to change lives in Northern Ireland.